So working on a new book for us called Political Ecology, and he's a contributing author, as Carl mentioned, to Rethinking Green. Randy?
A person that David and I know fairly well, Fred Smith, who founded the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., has a very nice line that I think summarizes what Michael just said. It's Fred's line is that the road to serfdom is paved with green bricks. Also, Michael could compare the line in the Declaration of Independence about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness with the line from the Canadian Charter of peace, order, and good government. Ways of thinking, very different ways of viewing how we might act in our lives. I have to warn you, I'm talking about politics, bureaucracy, courts, and the Endangered Species Act. I have to warn you that I am a politician. I'm mayor of my small town of 6,000 people. I'm a bureaucrat because I teach at a state university. And one of the things I teach is law and economics, law and policy, law and politics. So I can talk about the courts. I am just such an example of everything that's wrong in America. I'm going to talk specifically about the Endangered Species Act. The politics of the Endangered Species Act were that it was created in 1973 by under the Nixon administration. The Congress passed the law, and Richard Nixon gleefully signed it because it was such a good thing for the environment. It defined taking an endangered species, prohibited taking an endangered species, but and taking means to harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, wound, kill, trap, capture, or collect, or attempt to engage in such conduct. The problem is that you get that line from the politicians, and you move it to the bureaucracy. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who manages the Endangered Species Act, said, harm. What in the world do we mean by harm? Harm means, according to the Fish and Wildlife Service, habitat modification on private and public lands. So it includes those things. There's a host of other things, but one of the important ones is managing or changing habitat on private or public lands. I don't know why you're not in jail, Michael. Because you really modified that habitat. And then in the Sweet Home case in 1995, the Supreme Court said that habitat modification is in fact a harm, that Congress meant habitat modification to be included in the definition of harm and can be regulated under the Endangered Species Act. The result, according to Michael Bean, who is at Environmental Defense, Michael, by the way, is one of the most articulate members of the environmental community in talking about the Endangered Species Act, one of the most honest and careful analysts as well. And he's been very involved in trying to find ways to improve the Endangered Species Act, which actually almost got him excommunicated from the environmental movement for a while because of the points that Carl made about environmental regulation is often is ideologically driven. It often has very little to do with actual outcomes, and Michael's actually interested in outcomes. And he said, a forest landowner harvesting timber, a farmer plowing new ground, or a developer clearing land for a shopping center stood in the same position as a poacher taking aim at a whooping crane. So you modify your habitat, you might as well get the shotgun out and shoot what you can, because you're going to be treated exactly the same. In the Sweet Home decision, Justice Scalia dissented from the in this 5-4 vote and said, the court's holding imposes unfairness to the point of financial ruin, not just upon the rich, but upon the simplest farmer who finds his land conscripted to national zoological use. You thought Michael was making this stuff up, didn't you? Here we have Justice Scalia talking about having your land conscripted for national zoological use. So what are the results of 30 years of Endangered Species Act regulation? Does, using Scalia's phrase, does national zoological conscription work? What we find is that the answer is pretty much no. We have more endangered species than we had when we created the Endangered Species Act. More get added every year. Those that are on the list don't come off the list. A very tiny number have come off the list. I don't know that you can identify government actions as having had any effect on any of them, at least actions taken under the Endangered Species Act. They talk about bald eagles having come back, how wonderful that was. That probably had to do with, this was a government action actually, banning the use of DDT, but it had nothing to do with the Endangered Species Act. So you have a very small number that's come off the list. I don't know that you really can't ascribe any of that to the Endangered Species Act. Looking at this, you say, well, wow. 18% of those found only on public lands are improving. 3% of those found only on private land are improving. Less than 1 in 10 is improving. 4 in 10 are in decline. Wow. It's not so good. And then we look and we realize that 80% of all endangered species are found on private land. Places like Liberty Garden. Now, Michael Bean, again, he's willing to say the unsayable, which was a reason why he's sometimes not popular. He says, some claim that enforcing the Endangered Species Act has created unintended negative consequences, including antagonizing many of the landowners whose actions will ultimately determine the fate of many species. Antagonizing landowners. Yeah. There's rising evidence that people will actively manage their land so that there won't be endangered species. The problem with doing something to attract species is that then you can't do the things that you had wanted to do with your land, like maybe build 30 houses. There are severe restrictions placed on the things that you can do, so you better be careful about attracting them. What a lot of people do in places like Texas is they go out and rent a bush hog. A bush hog is a machine like a lawnmower that you pull behind your tractor, and you use it to just wipe everything off your property. If there's no habitat, there are no species. And then you can get what the Fish and Wildlife Service calls a bird letter. If you're in an area where there's an endangered bird, and the bird letter says you don't have you have no birds on your property and you have no habitat for them, therefore you can develop it. Now, again, Michael Bean says it's not that people have any malice towards the environment; it's just that they're rational. These are the predictable responses to silly regulation. He doesn't say silly regulation. He says it much more politely here. The National Association of Home Builders has a handbook on endangered species, and it has this little suggestion. Well, it's not really a suggestion, is it? They just say this is one of the things that happen. Farming, denuding of property, and managing the vegetation in ways that prevent the presence of such species are often employed in areas where ESA conflicts are known to exist. Not that you should do them. Environmental Defense quoted a farmer saying, I cannot afford to let those woodpeckers take over the rest of the property. I'm going to start massive clear cutting. This is called preemptive habitat destruction. Before the red-cockaded woodpeckers come, you cut your trees, because red-cockaded woodpeckers require trees of a certain size, about 50 to 60 years old. So you normally would harvest at 60 to 80 years. So you harvest them at 30 to 40 years. You don't make as much money, but you make money. One of the arguments that is often made by people who think that this is so terrible is, well, people can still make money with their trees, even if they do have red-cockaded woodpeckers and are managed by the regulations of the Fish and Wildlife Service. They can, for example, these are a long-leaf pine, long-needled pine. Yeah, they can still rake the straw, the needles, and sell it for straw. I mean, people do that. It's just this very tiny part of their income. But they're still able to do that. Now, I teach at a university in northern Utah. We get lots of ranch kids from the West. And when I, in my freshman class, there are always some kids sitting on the back row in baseball hats. Real cowboys that don't wear cowboy hats, they wear baseball hats. and they, I say, so, what would you do if a wolf or a grizzly showed up on your ranch? And there's some giggling at the back, and so I call on one of them, and they say, well, we just shoot, shovel, and shut up. Well, shoveling for a hole for a grizzly is a pretty big hole, but they have tractors with front loaders. It's just a phrase that is really widely known. And I always have students who get so upset that these other students would say this, because it's just such an awful thing to be doing. I mean, we ought to be letting wolves run wild and grizzlies, and we ought to be protecting species in all that we do. Well, maybe we should, but the difference between shoulds and what we do are often very different, especially when it comes to deciding when the should. The real question is, who should pay? Because right now, the way the Endangered Species Act is set up, people who own property like Liberty Gardens are people who end up paying if they get an endangered species. And the rest of us say, isn't that nice? Look, he has some endangered plants on that property. And we're so glad that he's done it. And we feel so good and so warm knowing that they're there. And we didn't pay a dime. Well, so what about this story of preemptive habitat destruction? Are these just stories, or are there real data? Well, it turns out there really are data. This is a study about red-cockaded woodpeckers done by Dean Luke and his co-author, whose first name is escaping me, last name is Michael. Luke and Michael looked at a very large data set and found that the closer your trees are to a known red-cockaded woodpecker colony, the earlier you harvest them. The more the miles you are from that known colony, the more you're likely to let them grow a little longer. And they found that enough habitat was reduced because of preemptive habitat destruction between 1984 and 1990 that it would have supported a red-cockaded population sufficient to meet the Fish and Wildlife Service's recovery goals. So we wiped out enough habitat to have met the recovery goals because of these really nasty incentives in the Endangered Species Act. So what do we do? One of the first things we do is we recognize that regulation doesn't work. But it makes bureaucrats, interest groups, and politicians, it allows them to pretend that it does. We can say, look how much we've allocated to endangered species recovery. Look, we've established this habitat protection plan. We've established this recovery plan. Not that any of that is really going to have any effect on actually recovering the species, but it lets us pretend that it does. And what the regulation is, the regulations are really, they're in effect an unlimited budget for bureaucrats. Now, I have to tell you, as a bureaucrat, I like to spend money, especially since it's other people's money. And sometimes I have to say, wait a minute, you're acting just like a bureaucrat. If I can make rules for people, see, as mayor, if I can get my city council to make rules for people about how they have to live their lives, I can increase all kinds of costs for them and never have to pay for it myself. And so the unlimited budget is I can always create more rules, whether or not I have an effect. But what if bureaucrats really had a real budget? A budget that they spent and only had so much of. Might they think differently about how that money gets spent and about the outcomes, especially since you might actually be having to report to politicians about the things you've accomplished? Of course we would lie. We would claim that we'd done more than we had done. We would claim we're more effective than we're really being, but could we be worse than we currently are? I don't know that we could. So here are some suggestions, some ways to think about the Endangered Species Act. One idea is let's change the incentives. For example, we could create something we would call rental contracts. We could come to Michael and say, Michael, you know, you have all these great plants here, and this particular set is endangered. What if we offer to pay you a bounty, essentially, for producing more? Make it in your interest to produce more, as opposed to penalizing you if you produce more. What if we went to a farmer and said, you know, if you just put off doing this activity for a couple of years, this particular species might be able to get itself reestablished. And then you could go on with your activities and pay them to not do that activity for a couple of years. So you give up, postpone, or undertake conservation. I think we might find bureaucrats shopping to find the best ways to actually accomplish their goals. They might act like entrepreneurs instead of like regulators. And if bureaucrats were doing that, it would certainly end the incentives for preemptive habitat destruction. Another idea is a form of compensation fund. Now, the most well-known compensation fund is the one that Defenders has, called the Bailey Wildlife Foundation Compensation Trust. It shifts. What it does is, if I'm a rancher and I lose a cow and a calf, or five goats and a pig, to a wolf, I get the vet to come and say, "Yep, that sure looked like a wolf. Like a wolf did that to me." The vet signs a form. I turn the form into the Bailey Conservation Fund and get reimbursed for that value. Now, you know, anytime you have to turn something into an insurance company, it's not as good as if you still had what you had. There are always, just the transaction costs of going through the process means that it's difficult, but it's sure a heck of a lot better than not getting anything for them. I mean, we were on Lake Powell last week, and my wife tried to stop the houseboat from running into a post as we came into the slip. And so her hand got hurt rather badly. And so we ran to there's a clinic at the Bullfrog Marina. I went to the clinic, and there was a $610 bill from having stitched her up and getting her the pain meds that she needed so that she could survive the rest of our week, because she wasn't leaving. So now we have to go through the process of getting reimbursed for the $610. You have to do the same kind of process here. It's not perfect, but whatever we get from our insurance company will be better off than if we didn't get it. Whatever you get for your cow and your calf and your five goats and your pig, you're a lot happier than before. And you've shifted the cost of having the wolf from you as a farmer to those who really want to have the wolves. The Delta Waterfowl Foundation is an organization that exists for ducks. They want ducks. Now, it turns out they want ducks because they like to shoot ducks. Yeah. People who like to shoot things actually pay money. But the Delta Waterfowl Foundation has identified ways of getting farmers to not fill in their prairie potholes in Manitoba, you know, southern Canada, and the northern middle states in the U.S., these prairie potholes fill up with water, ducks fly in, they nest. And so they have a program where you can adopt a pothole. You can go to their webpage, and for $125, you can adopt a one-acre pothole. That money goes to the farmer. Now, that's not very much money. And these ducks aren't endangered. But if you had a system where you were actually saying, you know, protect this little wetland, make it more attractive to the endangered species, and we'll pay you. And the more you produce, the more we'll pay you. You know, they have a system. They put out hen houses, and they get 80% of the eggs that hatch actually fledge. They fly away. Versus 20% when you don't have the hen houses. It's pretty darn creative, and it's really not that expensive to be changing the behavior of the farmers. They have something called the Alternate Land Use Services. That's a fair market value funding that is actually, now this is a partial government program, partial private. These private people put money in, the government and puts money in, especially in Manitoba. They're working on this very fair amount, but they're spending $600,000, and they are they have gotten farmers to protect over 135,000 acres. Now that's like $5 an acre of prairie potholes. Something that is relatively inexpensive, but everybody's happier. Think about it. If you went out in your backyard tomorrow and there was somebody had put a Picasso painting out there and it was now, you know, had your name on it. Now, you may really dislike Picasso and think his work stinks, but you'd be pretty darn happy. Now think about what would happen if you went into your backyard and found a spotted owl. Some people think that they're far more valuable than Picasso paintings. But you'd be unhappy because, in the first place, you got the Picasso painting, you can make money from it. In the second case, you have the spotted owl, and you now can't do anything with your backyard. So we're trying to make it so that having an endangered species is like having the painting. One possibility where we have public lands, as opposed to just private lands, is a concession, a conservation concession, where you actually buy the right to a piece of property, and instead of cutting down the trees, you leave them standing. Conservation International has some interesting programs where, for example, they created the Tena Gorilla Preserve in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where they paid money to local villages. And paying that money meant that the villages actually were better off than they were before. The gorillas are better off than they were before. They're not conservation refugees, the ones that David mentioned at the beginning. The Loomis Forest in Washington State is a case where 70 organizations and businesses came together and raised $16.5 million to buy a concession on the Loomis Forest. The Loomis Forest was dedicated to the income from that was dedicated to public schools. So they had it appraised, said, here's the value, here's the money. It's just another way of thinking about how we might set things aside or not set things aside, but find other ways to manage them. The Zimbabwe Campfire Program is one of the most interesting. And Robert Mugabe is doing his best to destroy Zimbabwe. And this program is in deep political trouble right now. It's really sad. Because what it is a program where local villages get the rights to the wildlife. And these are villages of 35, 40 people. They have the rights to the wildlife. And so they can sell safari hunts or sell, actually they don't have the sophistication, but they sell the rights to hunt to safari companies that then bring in people. I have great slides, you know, showing an elephant that was shot by a great white hunter. The hunter gets to take home the ivories. The meat was all laid out in on these kind of like palm fronds in 35 piles for each family in the village. They had these, you know, plastic milk crates, two of them filled with cash, real cash money. And the family got to take out of one, they got to take out the money that went to them, that family personally. Out of the other one, they took their share of what's called their communal money, and they then got to vote with those dollars. They're actually real Zimbabwe dollars, they're called dollars. And they had some bowls. Do you want to spend your money on drilling a new well? Do you want to spend your money on a village school? And they vote with their dollars. When there's enough money for one of those projects, then they do the project. Suddenly, these wildlife are really valuable to people. And one thing you have to remember about elephants is that they are pretty nasty creatures. I mean, they're really cute, and those of us in the Western world think, aren't they wonderful? And they, the ants adopt their orphaned nieces and nephews. It's just really a wonderful thing. They're, for somebody who lives among them, they're like giant rats. They can wipe out an entire year's food supply in one night. They stomp your garden areas. They're not something that you necessarily want to have around. But you can develop fences that actually keep them out if you have the cash. I spent some time with Marshall Murphy, a man who helped design that system. And Marshall said that the village, one of the first village that he worked with, had children who walked 35 miles every Monday and back every Saturday to school, a boarding school. And they lost 5 children to lions that previous year. They build a schoolhouse. He's a cultural anthropologist. He said, you know what's really strange is the language changed. Instead of talking about the wildlife, they started talking about our wildlife. They had a real interest in making sure that there were wildlife around. I had a student from Zambia. His name is Fidelis Lungo. And Fidelis came back to the United States. He stopped and visited. And he was promoting safaris in Zambia. He'd gotten a degree in wildlife management. And he said, you know, the thing that really shocked me in wildlife management in Zambia was that I discovered that I spend a lot more time managing people and wildlife. He said, and we finally caught the biggest poacher in the Luangwa Valley. And we brought him into court, and the prosecutor lined up all these villagers who had helped him and said, why did you help the poacher? Well, he gave me a bag of sugar. Why did you help the poacher? He gave me some trousers. Why did you help the poacher? He gave me some food. And Fidelis said it was like getting hit in the face with a board. Because I suddenly realized that the poachers were making those people's lives better, and those of us in wildlife management were making their lives worse. And so, in part because of that, Fidelis worked with people in Zambia to establish the same, in Zimbabwe, to establish the same kind of approach in Zambia. And the biggest poacher in the Luangwa Valley, when I talked to Fidelis, was driving a 2-ton truck for one of the safari companies. Making more money. He was better off. The wildlife were better off. The villagers were better off. Now if they could just deal with AIDS, which actually killed Fidelis, things would be going along really quite well. A conclusion. Let me take a line from Aldo Leopold. Conservation will ultimately boil down to rewarding the private landowner who conserves the public interest. The current Endangered Species Act punishes landowners who conserve the public interest. And no claims about the value of biodiversity or moralizing about the diversity of life will change that basic fact. If we want to conserve species, we need to make it in people's individual interest to do so. If we don't, we're going to continue to fool ourselves with regulations. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for some questions. Is Kenny here for the... Okay, great. Melissa has the microphone. So if you use the microphone and when you use it, hold it horizontally. One thing I might also just throw out as part of the discussion is what's called the tragedy of the commons. Many of you may be familiar with that term. The tragedy of the commons was a term coined by Garrett Hardin at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And it describes a problem that exists within resources that are in a common status. And this relates to what all three speakers were talking about. In other words, when a resource is in a common status, everyone owns it in common, meaning no one owns it. And the tendency is to fight, have conflicts to shift costs for utilizing the resource onto others, and to have an incentive to extract the resource before your neighbor gets it. So the opposite of this is when you actually have what our three speakers are talking about, when you actually have ownership rights in resources, which creates incentives for people to conserve, manage, and be responsible. So, questions for this gentleman right here.
Thank you. Speaking of the problem with the tragedy of the commons, and going back to your efforts to fight the weeds and the non-native species, when I go to a lot of state and regional parks, I see tremendous growth of what I call star thistle, terrible, which just is, you know, unforgivable. You can't even get near it. And nobody ever seems to be cutting it down. It just keeps on multiplying. I wonder if you've dealt with it and if there's any way we can keep things like that from spreading the state through incentive.
Well, I've not dealt with that. I've not dealt with that, so I don't know the management technique for it. It really, though, always comes down to a matter of seed bank management. And the problem that government agencies have with managing star thistle or anything else is that they're here today and gone tomorrow. North County in Santa Cruz, San Luis Obispo, has taken on some management dynamics. And they're just utter failures. They attack the seeds at the wrong time of year. If I were to go after star thistle, you just got to be sure that none of the seeds become viable. And that's a multi-year project because the seeds in the ground last for a certain amount of time depending upon the species. And you just have to keep going at it. The state agencies are not in a position to do that. They don't have guaranteed funding. They don't have a long-term view of any of these things. It's all about the political grab for the day. And so there's no commitment to the long-term seed bank management that's necessary to eradicate star thistle or anything else.
Okay. The lady right there.
I just wanted to ask you on that. What did you do? How did you deal with the poison oak?
Well, it's a good thing that in California there are ample Mexican people with Indian heritage, and poison oak doesn't bother them. And at the same time, they know how to use a machete. So it's machete work, firstly, and when it comes back up, you know, Monsanto's Roundup does a wonderful job. Yeah, Roundup is our magic for a lot of species. You have to be careful because it can retard the growth of other plants. But once you've managed it via machete is the magic tool. You can get yourself positioned for an effective knock it out with Roundup.
Gentlemen, right here.
Could you explain what seed bank management? Could you give me a detail?
When I was a boy in Southern California, the thing my parents always made me do was weed the yard. And after so many years of weeding the same thing again and again, I figured out that if the seeds didn't fall, it's just a matter of weeding out the seed bank that was already in the ground. So seed bank management is making sure that the seeds from this year's crop of weeds don't become viable. And you do that long enough, and most species then die out.
We have the same 10 years, 7 year CD.
We had a saying that 1 year's weeding is 7 years seeding. Did you clear 7 years of seed just by 1 year of weeding?
I think that makes logical sense to me. I mean, you just don't want the seeds of the plants you don't want to fall. And eventually the balance changes. The nice thing about at least coastal California is that the seed banks of the native plants for a long time. I mean, they're used to a fire regime in this state that comes every few decades, and so poison oak takes over everything. And in the old days, my speculation is that the variety, the biodiversity, would last for a very short period of time before poison oak would just take over. and it would hold the ground for decades until a fire would come through, and then these interesting plants would grow until overwhelmed by poison oak again.
I was wondering, Mr. Simmons, you talked about the organization that would refund or compensate farmers for dead cattle and such. Where did it get its funding? Who are the people that wanted the wolves so much that they would pay for that?
You'd be surprised at how many people are thrilled at the thoughts of large carnivores wandering the wild. And the defenders used to be called Defenders of Wildlife. They have, there's a foundation that gave them a bunch of money, and people then can contribute to that as well to create this essentially trust fund that they use to for making their reimbursements. And they've been really good about paying people. It's really astonishing. Now, I spend a lot of my time in wilderness areas, not a lot, a few weeks every summer. I don't go to places where there are grizzlies. I was really pleased to have llamas with me last year because llamas are very good at spotting carnivores and making noise and stomping their feet, and actually they're good at stomping dogs. There are people who just it really makes them feel good to know that there are those large carnivores out there, and they're willing to spend money on it. Once they recognized, and that, this is something that the folks at Defenders, actually the person who did it was Hank Fisher, that Hank really promoted. Hank used to just go to these meetings to talk about reintroducing wolves in the West, and he was the most hated person in the room. And then once Hank started saying, "Why did they hate me?" And realized, "Wait a minute, I'm making their lives worse." It was like Fidelis saying, "I got like getting hit in the face with a board." Hank said, "Well, let's then find ways to reimburse them," and it changed. People didn't necessarily like Hank more, but they liked his ideas. They were at least willing to say, "Okay, if they're gonna come, then if you'll reimburse me, then I'm willing to accept them."
I might add that there is a whole range of conservation groups that are involved in this kind of thing. We're talking about dealing with trout, dealing with wild horses, dealing with just an enormous range of things. Absolutely. Well, there's a big history, and there's more specialized groups, and I think it's fair to say that almost all the major conservation success stories are ones that are like Michael's, where a group goes out, they buy a piece of land, they want to save the black rhino or something, and the biggest problem they have is they run smack into these different bureaucratic groups, which have their own agenda. And the irony of all this is that if you're concerned about sensitive habitat or some ecological balanced situation or something that's endangered, why would you put in a position of authority people who can't be held accountable if they make bad decisions? But that's exactly what political authority and bureaucratic authority is. The San Francisco Bay is run by a number of government agencies. If those agencies make a mistake, and they make mistakes all the time, dealing with fish population, pollution issues, landfill issues, and so on, they're not accountable. Instead, everyone else pays for the cost through taxes as a result. So how could anybody believe that such a system is going to be able to overcome the three problems that Carl has pointed out? More questions. The gentleman right here. That's right.
We've just talked about the environmental protection. Is there also, does anybody care to comment or know anything about, I've heard this from farmers that I know in my area, about cultural anthropological protectionism. For example, you have a property and you have Indian burial ground or something of that nature or some artifacts. Does anyone know of that? Have you comment on that? Because I've heard if I see that on my property, I'll trash it. I'll take out my plow and I'll plow it under my cat and destroy it. It's the same. It's an analogous problem.
It is very much an analogous problem because those cultural resources are found on your property and you tell anybody about them, then you immediately get shut down in your activities while a survey is done to identify all of the ones that are there and figure out what you can do with them and what you can't. It depends on... there are state laws and also federal laws that manage what you can do. In eastern Utah, there was a family who had a very large ranch, and they kept secret for 50 years. And how they managed to do this, I don't know. The petroglyphs that are on their ranch... just a completely astonishing set of cultural artifacts that they did keep secret. They finally have announced that they're there, and the problem is I think they've turned their ranch over to the government to manage, so they may all disappear.
Two more questions. Gentleman in the back.
A lot of really interesting information and kind of indicating that there's some big power here that's supporting this, the United Nations or whatever it happens to be, and how this is affecting people at local level. Can any of you share if there is any specific place that this is coming from and who's doing this and what their purposes are and what their goals are?
I'm not a conspiracy theorist. Sustainable development just sounds so nice, doesn't it? It's a great line. Smart growth as opposed to dumb growth. My university president wanted to make a name for himself because he was actually looking to find other become a president at a more prestigious university. Decided that he would establish a sustainable Utah State University would be a would practice sustainable policies, whatever that means, but he didn't want them to be he knew that it was a politically popular word. But he really didn't want to be changing anything necessarily that the university was doing. So he put me in charge of the committee and charged me to make things look good. It's a popular word. It's a popular phrase. It sounds really good. There are sets of people who just believe strongly that that the difference between life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and peace, order, and good government. It's an ideological driven approach I can't say that person or that group is doing it. Lots of them are.
There are always, I mean, as Michael has pointed out, there are entities that push agendas, and some of them are powerful and some of them are well funded. But the bottom line is the ideas that people find receptive, as Randy is saying. So if people will buy into certain things and they will go along with it. And the question is, is it sensible? So I'm afraid that'll have to be our last comment. I want to thank our speakers for joining with us. I want to thank you all for joining with us. We're delighted that we had a chance to have you join with us for what's a very important issue, and we look forward to you joining with us the next time. Thank you and good night.
Excellent.